CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 50 with Firas Rahal, an ophthalmologist and also a partner at Excite Ventures. Now, you've been to the meetings, the academy, the ASRS, local meetings, and you look at the speaker, the key opinion leader, and they show a slide of disclosures. Yes, they're a speaker for one company, a consultant for the other, but the one that strikes your fancy is, ooh, ownership stake. And so you can be involved in ophthalmology, work with smaller company startups, and actually have an ownership stake in the company, stock options or having stock directly or investing in it. And I've done that in the past, and it's something that I love to do because I love ophthalmology. And I really have a keen insight because what do we know? I know ophthalmology. I know cataract surgery. If there's a technique or technology in this field, I will understand it and I will know in my heart, in my brain, is this going to be great? So while I am invested with Excite Ventures and I have other investments in ophthalmology, you do what you want. Do what's best for you. I'm not giving any financial advice. As you know, I give cataract coach advice. But check it out. I think you'll find it very interesting because you can have an equity stake, an ownership stake in the future of ophthalmology. Really a fascinating topic. I'm sure you're going to love this podcast. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today we have a very special guest. We have Firas Rahal, who's a retina surgeon. And you're thinking, wait a minute, this is cataract coach. What's the retina guy doing here? We're going to talk all about, of course, ophthalmology. But the important part is we're talking about investing in ophthalmology. Like the one thing we actually know about is eyes. And Firas is part of a venture capital fund called Excite Ventures. And we're going to learn about this and how, if you want, you can become involved too. So Firas, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you, Uday. It's a pleasure to join you. As everybody who knows us knows, we've been friends a long time, and I'm aware of your podcast, and I've listened to your podcast, and I've been lucky enough to, I think, do a case with you that you put on to Cataract Coach when we did a combo case once years ago. So I enjoy your website, and the residents like rave over it, man. Every resident in the country tells me they know about Cataract Coach.
So your background is, you obviously did ophthalmology training. I think you were at Cornell. Then you did retina at UC San Diego. Yep. And you're in here in Los Angeles, you were like the go-to retina surgeon for the train wrecks, the complicated re-ops, the really difficult cases. Call Firas Rahal.
Yeah, man. Thank you. So, yeah, that my day job is still a very busy clinical vitreoretinal practice, as you know, with locations all over the LA area, one near you in Beverly Hills. We've shared a lot of patients over the years. I still enjoy doing surgery probably more than anything. It's more fun and enjoyable than clinic. I like both, but surgery is the best. And I appreciate those comments. And I like the fact that I have a lot of friends who are referring doctors. It's part of the collegiality that makes this kind of fun.
For sure. And in addition to that, your practice, which is very busy, you also teach or taught the UCLA residents, the USC residents. You should, for free, by the way. You just share your love with everyone. You love to teach as well.
I do like the teaching. And right now we're affiliated very closely with the USC fellowship and the residency, but more the vitreoretinal fellowship. It has become a combined fellowship between USC and our practice. Our practice, as you know, is called Retina Vitreous Associates Medical Group. We've been in LA longer than I've been here, 30 to 40 years or more. And many of the guys in our group have an academic background and like the teaching. Yes, it's for free. We're not on the full-time faculty of either institution. You and I did a lot of teaching together at UCLA for oh so many years, and I enjoyed that. The fellowship part of it is really amazing, watching a fellow go from the first month of the 2 years to the graduation period. It's incredible how much change happens in their surgical skill. And I'm happy we have a little part in that. It's fun and enjoyable.
Oh, for sure. I've sent you a few of my former residents who've been in your fellowship. Fantastic. And I hope you agree. I trained them right.
You did. In fact, I'll give you a name plug. I think he's in the clinic today down the hall. Dan Sue was one of your residents. He's one of our junior partners now and is one of the more, you know, excellent surgeons I've ever seen. His native skill at surgery and what you guys taught him at UCLA added to his own innate skills has been phenomenal. He's also a terrific clinician and diagnostician. We do, as you know, also in our group, tons of clinical trials. And I think nationally what we're known for are is the clinical trials. You know, Dave Boyer has been a legend in that space. We all have participated. I do a lot of them myself. We find that to be really stimulating and fun. And it's actually a segue. Well, how I got into a lot of this other stuff was initially my entree into the world of product development and industry was through the clinical trial principal investigator role or sub-investigator.
Right. Your retina group has done, I'd say, more than 100 clinical trials.
Yeah.
A huge number.
I think if you looked at all of them over the past 20 to 25 years, it's probably more than a few hundred now.
Wow.
Each of us share in the principal investigator role. Dr. Boyer has done the most by far. I've done a lot. A number of other guys like to participate and play the role of chief investigator, but we all participate in all of them by referring patients and following patients. It's been incredible. We're now, as you know, into the phase of gene therapies and stem cell therapies, and in the retina space, in the back of the eye, we're kind of proud to say that this is a lead area for the entire medical right. discipline, not just ophthalmology. We're kind of taking a lead on that for other disciplines.
Right, like AI is going to be first in ophthalmology, then spread to other fields. Gene therapy is already first in ophthalmology, and then will at some point spread to other fields. So you're right, there are a lot of firsts here. And then even the stuff with the anti-VEGF. How many of us wish that a decade ago I invested in companies involved in retina anti-VEGF stuff? Oh my goodness.
Yeah, totally. I mean, look, the Regeneron company, for example, which is a public company and makes great drug for, you know, Eylea for wet AMD, diabetic retinopathy. I think before the eye situation with anti-VEGF, I'm not sure they really had a product. That was probably their first and foremost. I may be wrong about that. They're doing other things. But Eylea was their blockbuster. And sure, I'm sure somebody who saw that coming 16, 18 years ago has done very well for themselves. Indeed.
Well, of course. Yeah, I mean, Eylea now alone has earned tens of billions of dollars. So it's a crazy number to even think about. But, you know, it just kind of begs the question that, you know, when it comes to other types of investing, let's say crypto, stocks, options, even real estate, I am dumber than a bucket of rocks. I just don't have any expertise in this. I didn't go to business school. I don't have an MBA. I've never been involved in this stuff. It seems like the only thing that you can't fool me on is ophthalmology, because I know eyeballs, especially anterior segment, especially cataract. You cannot fool me.
Yeah, you're totally right. It's a nuanced position, and it takes savvy to recognize that. And the truth is, we come to it, you probably did as well, I did, as you evolve in your career and you start doing investing, whether inside or outside of ophthalmology, you realize this is what you know. And there's some clues for the young people who are doing some of this out there. And these were the clues to me, Uday. I don't know if this was your experience.
Oh, tell me. I'm taking notes.
Yeah, I used to get, you know, as many of us do, calls from analysts and, you know, the Wall Street types to learn about things like anti-VEGF drugs. And these are conversations that are all public information. You're only sharing public information. That's all they want. They want to be careful not to delve into other areas. And as a clinical trialist and an investigator and an ophthalmologist in general, it all came very easy to me. And I thought, wow, these people really don't know that much about our space, yet they're making all this money in our space. So it started to occur to me to parlay our knowledge in our space. And I sometimes teach the fellows who have an interest in industry, you've been very successful in industry for all the obvious reasons, is that take advantage of our knowledge. In science, they get intellectual property. They get an IP fence to protect their idea. Our IP is our mind and our experience and our knowledge of clinical medicine. And for generations, doctors have been giving it away for nothing, honestly.
You know, it's a great point, because today there are so many ophthalmologists who are involved in, let's say, these consulting companies contacting ophthalmologists. If you will talk to this investment group for an hour, we'll pay you X amount of dollars. I don't give that info away. I do zero of that. Zero. Yeah. I'm not going to teach some slick Wall Street guy all that I know about the eye and all the insights I may have based because I killed, I gave away my 20s in order to be this ophthalmologist.
Yeah.
I gave away a sweet decade of life, your 20s. I gave it away.
A very good decade.
So I'm not giving that away for free. So yes, you're right. I've been involved in ophthalmology now in the consulting side more than 20 years. And my best investments of all time, well, first, probably the obvious one is investing in my kids' education. It's probably the no-brainer. That's the best.
100%. Right?
But in terms of just actual investing, it's like I was involved in early stage ophthalmology startups where like the stock options I had paid me like 12 to 1 or 20 to 1. Things that I just couldn't believe were actual reality until you get the check. And I'm like, you know, I'm like 37 years old. I think I'm pretty much set for life. It's a very strange thing.
Well, the return, look, we're ophthalmology is sort of by definition biotech. The experts will tell you for sure. We can talk about the risks separately. The risks are high in biotech, but the returns are very high. That's why people on Wall Street get into it. That's why any investor gets into it. We just happen to be in a space that's particularly productive in the last 20 years, to your point. Right. Very productive in technology and drugs and treatments and diagnostics, and we can get into some of that. But ophthalmology has been a lead area for investment and a lead area for outcomes and developments for the last 20 years. And to the point you made earlier, it's a breeding ground now for AI. We're a perfect fit for AI, right? We're heavily image-based, especially in the retina. Like, we got image after image after image. What could be a more perfect setup for AI entry into clinical medicine? Perfect. It's a closed space, somewhat sequestered, somewhat immune privileged. What could be more perfect for gene therapy and stem cell experimentation? So we're kind of still ripe for this. It's still ongoing, even though for the last 20 years we've had this great run of development and innovation. It's still blowing up. And I think we happen to be lucky to be in this space. On the financial side, if people are, you know, savvy and keeping their eye out, a lot of positive things could happen for you as an investor here.
Yeah, it's a super exciting time. Absolutely super exciting, because there's so much revolution coming in ophthalmology. Not just evolution, but I mean straight up revolution, whether it's the AI part, whether it's these new retinal treatments, which you obviously know much more than me about certain disease states. Now we're seeing, you know, 10 years or 5 years ago, we didn't see anything about geographic atrophy. Surprise, not so big deal. And you're going to have more and more retinal diseases that are going to be involved with these new developments, new technologies, but also now like fully robotic cataract surgery. I'm telling you now, it's coming. So it is just like, it's amazing.
It's definitely coming. It's so cool. I agree with you about the robotic and all those things. And with regard to, you know, let's say gene therapy for a minute, the number of models and paradigms are numerous. So the obvious is, okay, single gene rare disease concept. That's the Luxturna concept. Mm-hmm. And okay, there's only handfuls of patients, but payers have decided for good reason that vision is so valuable that they're willing to pay, you know, $800,000 per treatment for that one gene, one disease, you know, one eye. And then on the flip side, you have models that aren't approved yet that are in clinical trials where gene therapy is being used to create a biofactory to create proteins in the eye that mimic current protein drugs we're using, like ranibizumab in the RegenxBio model, which is in phase 3 clinical trials. So the number of paradigms are not endless, but they're certainly numerous, and it is revolutionary. This is the first. These are the first of their kind in the history of medicine. And we're lucky enough that it's happening a lot in the eye.
For our fellow ophthalmologists, you are so lucky to be an ophthalmologist, because literally it is a precursor to what's going to happen to the rest of medicine. Like we said earlier, the first AI stuff now that's approved is ophthalmology. You're going to see the gene therapy that was approved. Well, you said Luxturna, it's ophthalmology. The first truly automated robotic stuff, Mark my words, it's going to be ophthalmology. So it's really a fantastic field. And then remember, if you love cataracts like me, that's the number one surgery in America. If you like intravitreal injection like for us, that's the number one procedure in America.
Yeah. You know, and there's been talk about trying to utilize robots for that too. I mean, for obvious reasons. Look, every year the number of people needing injections, because the disease states that we can cover keeps growing, and the population's aging, so it's an endless supply, so to speak, of need for injections. And there's only so much human capacity. We may find a way to automate it better using AI, using robotics. And for sure, cataract surgery, I agree with you. We're both interested and involved in some programs. It's coming. It's a perfect surgery, in my opinion, to be automated that way, right? The perfect surgery looks the same almost every time. That's kind of the goal. When I watch you do a cataract, it looks the same every time, except if you're doing an exceptionally, you know, out of norm one. But the normal regular ones, and that's the beauty of it, that can be automated using AI and various imaging systems and, of course, robotics. I think it's pretty phenomenal, and a lot of people think that's coming. I agree with you. I don't know exactly how the robot works, you know, in urological surgery, but I agree that's more like surgeon assisted than fully automated. And
right, so the Da Vinci robot, actually, so let's say for a robotic prostatectomy, the Da Vinci robot is still driven or controlled by a surgeon who's at a console with 3D vision and some basically hand pieces to control the instrumentation. So they can operate through multiple ports and obviously a very confined space, the pelvis. But an even more confined space is the anterior segment, which is all less than a cc. So
yeah.
It's a very tiny space.
Yeah, and I think for the people, I'm glad to hear you talk about it, because as a high volume, super talented cataract surgeon, you're obviously not threatened by it. You're excited for it. And I think for the people who think, oh, automation is coming, it's going to displace me, that's never happened throughout history. Right. Forgetting ophthalmology, manufacturing, bank tellers, they're not replaced. What happens is the human factor goes to a higher level of thought and complexity, and it just augments what we're doing already with our brains and our own hands. So I don't think anyone should feel threatened by automation. I think it'll make us better and more efficient.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And remember still, you know, it's like I fly on a plane that has autopilot, but I assure you the pilot is still actually very much required.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point. Thank God for that. I totally agree with that.
And it's similar. If you look at just something in ophthalmology, let's look at like refractive surgery. You know, the very first time I did LASIK in 1999 or 98, the microkeratome to make the corneal flap was totally mechanical. It didn't have a motor. I actually pushed it with my fingers across the cornea to create a flap. Then we got to a motorized microkeratome. And now we just use a femtosecond laser. And so you still need the surgeon.
Still need the surgeon, still need the thinking, the technique, the knowledge, the clinical assessment. It's all still surgeon dependent. The more automated doesn't mean that the surgeon's going to become obviated. We agree on that. And I think most people, when they sit down and think about it, and LASIK is an excellent example for this. I didn't even think of it myself. Why people shouldn't worry about automation. I'll give you an example in our space where augmentation, which may be more realistic for us in the early phases for retina, it would be amazing. So, you know, because you've seen us do it, we can peel these fine membranes off of the macula. They're 10 microns or less. And the trick is to do it with as little contact or trauma to the underlying retina tissue as possible. That's the skill in it. And it's a very challenging thing to do repeatedly, perfectly. And one of the reasons is in ophthalmology, certainly in retina, there's no tactile response. This is all visual. You have to have excellent optics, and we do. Imagine if you could make the touchdown of the forceps on the internal limiting membrane magnified 1,000-fold, that your hand inside this device would vibrate, that you just touched the ILM. How brilliant would that be, that you would never dig too deep because you'd know instantaneously when you were touching the ILM. I think that's coming at some point too, like an augmentation of and create what doesn't exist now, which is tactile response.
Right. And you could have a step down as well. So you move the instrument, let's say 1 millimeter outside the eye, it steps it down by 1/20th.
Yeah.
So now in the eye, it only moves 0.05 millimeters or 50 microns. So you only right, one exactly. millimeter, it was 50 microns, you could have a much higher level of precision.
Yeah, totally. It does take away, and if it takes away the tremor factor to some extent. And when you, if you were to measure tremor measurements, there's no question the mobility of these tips mm-hmm. in the hands, so to speak, of a robot are universally better than in the hands of even us experienced surgeons who've had good results for a long right. time. So the results will get better. They'll get more consistent. And one person said to me, an investment guy some years ago about this, as we were talking about, you know, robotic cataract surgery to be specific. And he used the term, he said, this will democratize, you know, cataract surgery. Right. Not everyone gets the results you get on every case. And that's a great commendation for you. And there's a lot of great cataract surgeons, but the robot will do it the same way, presumably every single time in every single city in the world, right? It's a democratization.
Right. Like making a LASIK flap now with a femtosecond laser is pretty dang consistent. As yeah. opposed to the old days when I had to use a mechanical finger push microkeratome where there's all yeah. very little there.
Yeah, I heard of cases where the flap would come off completely and things like that in those days, which makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, so I think we're definitely headed there. Now, my disclosure for my viewers is I'm a big investor in this. I have invested my own personal funds in a robotic cataract surgery company, and I'm also involved in your venture capital fund, your VC fund, which is called Excite Ventures. So this is not a solicitation. You do you. I have zero knowledge about accounting or finance. I'm dumber than a bucket of rocks, but I do know ophthalmology.
Yeah, no, and this is how, if I could take a minute, this is how Excite Ventures came to exist. It wasn't my idea. I was one of the founding partners. The idea came from a couple of the other guys in the group. One you mentioned earlier, we were discussing James Murray and Michael Nissen. We're the three partners right now, and there's some other people who helped us found it. It's a great idea. It's basically niche investing, right? It's investing in the space that you know best. Michael also is a vitreoretinal surgeon in New York. And so this is our space, ophthalmology. So I'm not sure how he came to the idea with others. I have some original anecdotes about it. But the bottom line is there's actually writings among finance professors now, one of which had a role in founding our group, that niche investing has a greater return than sort of the run-of-the-mill general investing. And to just the common person, that makes a lot of sense, right? If you're betting a long shot, but you know the arena really well, and now the long shot is a little bit less of a long shot, mm-hmm. you're going to, at the end of the day, after many, many investments, be ahead. And so that was sort of the purpose. We don't get outside of our lane. We haven't made any investments outside of ophthalmology. But to the points we were discussing earlier about how the broadening of healthcare in some areas might actually start in the eye, one of our investments that exited, and I can speak about this because this is public information, is a gene therapy company out of San Diego. It's called DTX. And they originally were doing research in retinitis pigmentosa gene therapy. We liked that. We learned of it. We decided to join them and invest. And they ultimately exited more on their other platform, which is in neurodegenerative disease, to Novartis. And so although the RP program still exists, they've sort of transitioned into a neurodegenerative program, which turned out to be a much bigger program and was a very nice exit for us and very gratifying to see the products going to help patients in the coming years, we hope.
Oh, fantastic. So again, if you want to learn more about the investment that your company has made, it's Excite Ventures, E-X-S-I-G-H-T Ventures.com. And if you want to have a contact page, you can do exciteventures.com/Uday, U-D-A-Y.
And so there you go.
You can see if you came from the Cataract Coach podcast. But no, I am personally involved in your VC fund as an investor. I'm not soliciting or giving any advice, but I'm just saying to me, it made a ton of sense. And what I loved was like certain things like the robotic cataract surgery company that I invested in on my own, you're also in.
Yeah, like, yeah.
You both 100%. Came to the same conclusion.
We came to the same conclusion, and We, by the way, we're thrilled to have you on the team, and your role is growing by the minute, which makes me happy. And I'm sure it's fun for you. This is fun. We're enjoying this. We're having a lot of interesting conversations and meetings. We receive so many pitches from brilliant innovators. Some are in the very earliest stages, you know, literally university level, haven't spun out into a company yet. And that is actually when we started some of the dialogues with the folks in the robotics program, as you did. Sure. We knew of this in its infancy as an academic, it wasn't even a startup yet. It was an academic idea. Right. And so we both, knowing the project, both individually liked it, and it turned out both individually invested in it. And this is how a lot of them start. So many. And for the innovators that are listening, there's a real skill set and science to how you develop your program within the university, and then using proper advice and tech transfer and IP, spin it out. There's a timing to it. It's very important that's done right for the innovator to really benefit from their own idea, and then also for it to succeed on the outside. There's a lot of skill in that, and I've learned a lot in the last decade from other people who are expert in this area.
So Excite Ventures is not investing in already publicly traded companies. You're a very early stage investor then.
Correct. So Excite makes exclusively private investments into private companies. We don't do any public investing into stock market shares and so forth. And most of the investments are early stage. First of all, the check sizes for those are more within our realm to be able to, you know, get involved. And also, this is essentially where, if you're willing to take the risk, where the niche advantage, the being in the space advantage, is going to exist. By the time a company gets to a phase 3 clinical trial on a drug or a therapeutic, everybody and their uncle knows about it. You know, all the Wall Street people already, they're up to raising hundreds of millions at that point. And good for them. They'll exit and do well, but the return multiple is 10 times that much if you're in early and you happen to know enough to get it at the earlier stage when it's a little more affordable. So we're in the early space, one, by design, and two, to some extent by necessity, because those phase 3 or later kind of developments are really big money for the bigger and sort of name brand VCs at the back end. We'd like to be able to be part of that, actually, and we're interested as we move forward in having what we would call an opportunity fund. What we found is we've made some really nice investments early on, and they've done well. And then they need to go and raise for their later rounds of development, very expensive. It sort of prices us out. We participate, but at a smaller level. Sure. And we sort of giving away all this great diligence we put in to somebody who comes and goes, oh yeah, these guys did a good job. They're pretty smart. I like this product. Here's $100 million. And they end up owning, you know, 60% of the company. So we would love to move to a phase where we can have a second program. So like a so-called opportunity fund, where we can kind of double down on our own initial investment if we have those kind of partners who have that kind of capacity.
For sure. And you're invested in many companies. I was looking at your website there. Again, it's exciteventures.com/Uday. And on that website, you've got a bunch of different companies you invest in. So it's the whole eye. I saw
it's one. The
whole eye. You have glaucoma companies. You have developing IOL companies. You have corneal endothelial companies. You've got the spectrum.
So I'm glad you brought that out because Michael and I, who are 2/3 of the general partnership right now, our retina doctors, when we go to meetings, a lot of people assume we're only looking for posterior segment and only invest in posterior segment. That turns out to be false, as you correctly just identified. I would say the majority are not posterior segment. We do have lens implant. We do have glaucoma procedures and products and diagnostics, you know, office-based diagnostics that are used by general ophthalmologists or even optometrists, right? So our niche space is the whole eye. And what I found, and I don't know if Michael, Dr. Nissen, had this experience. He probably did. It was like going back and doing an intellectual residency when I started doing this, because I now know more about glaucoma than I did 10 years ago, even though I'm 28 years out from fellowship, because I had to really dig in when I would do diligence on tube shunts, or more importantly, like the MIGS explosion, right? That was something we were very interested in. And it was one of our pillar areas when we formed the company 10 years ago. We can talk about this, but lens implants was a pillar area for us. MIGS procedures were pillar areas for us. Gene therapy and robotics, among a couple of, and drug delivery were all five or six of the pillar areas we wanted to be in. And it took us a few years to slowly chip away at which ones we found that we thought were the best horse to bet on in those spaces. And yeah, it is the whole eye. And so I go to the academy now and I attend, you know, glaucoma meetings, because I want to hear what's hot in glaucoma. And hence, you can help us a lot now that you've been with us. You're going to help us, you know, look at who knows cataract surgery better than you, certainly better than me. And this is what will be brought to the table when you put a bunch of minds together who are knowledgeable in a space, and there's synergy there between all of us. And it's actually fun. It's actually fun.
Oh, I think it's a lot of fun. I'm so like you, when there's a new company that I'm thinking about investing in, let me just do a lot of homework here. And the nice part of what I enjoy about being in, invested in your VC fund is that, you know what, I don't have to go a deep dive in retina, because I trust that the retina investments you made, you've done the deep dive. But then when it comes to the anterior segment stuff, I'm like, okay, let me see. Tell me the conclusions you came to, and let me see if I agree.
And we 100% want that. And that's one of the key reasons, other than you and I have been good friends for 20 plus years, to have people like you in it. One, it's fun and we work together. But absolutely, if I'm looking at an IOL project, even before you were part of Xsight, I'm going to call you and say, hey, what do you think about this? But now that you're with us, it's even more formalized, and we'll be, you know, having meetings with you. We have some glaucoma people that are in the program as LPs, and they help out. We invite them to join us for meetings with the companies. We take pitches, you know, a couple times a week. We have these slots that are blocked out for us between the East Coast and the West Coast. We've worked out a pretty good system, because look, you have to stay on this. This can't be, I'm fully in on clinics during the day, but I've carved out afternoons and some early morning periods to do these meetings. So I've carved into my clinical schedule to stay on this. And then when it's an anterior segment product, of course, we have a great team of people, you being one of them, and say, hey, could you join this call with us and hear what these guys have to say and get your take? We'll usually screen it first to see if we feel like it's a, if it's high level, we might have a couple of calls with the people. And then as we're getting into deeper diligence, bringing a friend and colleague who's expert is perfect for asking the really pointed questions.
You know, it took me so long to figure out that, yeah, I should actually invest with my expertise. Like I said, if it comes like I own no crypto, I can't even understand it. I'm not a big stock guy, option guy. I don't day trade. I don't do this. Real estate, this. You can fool me in a second. Like I said earlier, when it comes to that stuff, I am dumber than a bucket of rocks. But boy, you start talking ophthalmology, my ears perk up. You start talking some anterior segment stuff, and then cataract. Oh, yeah. I got you, baby. I know everything I need to know.
And we're going to utilize that, but you're totally spot on with your comment. Because I've been doing this for a while now, a lot of people assume that I'm a wheeler dealer on the stock market and day trade. I'm like, I don't do any of that stuff. I absolutely don't know what crypto is. I've had my son, the engineer, explain it to me like 100 times. I still couldn't explain it to anybody. I don't have any idea what crypto is or how it works. I most certainly wouldn't danger myself to invest, because although it might be a great investment, what does the ombudsman of Omaha always say? I can't invest in anything I can't like understand or explain. Buffett, you know, and that's true. And I think, you know, for stock trading, look, we all have investments with mutual funds and so forth, and we rely on investment experts. I don't have the time to be on the day trading, looking at, you know, computer all day long. And it doesn't interest me. This is a more fascinating and fun and really potentially great upside way to invest, because again, to your point, we're capitalizing on something we've spent decades honing our skill on. And I don't think doctors have historically taken advantage of it. In fact, I think we've been woefully bad at taking advantage of our, to use my term, intellectual property, which is our skill and understanding. And those calls that you were referring to that you're like, yeah, I'm not going to give them this. I made some of those calls. I took some of those calls 20 years ago, paid pretty well to take a consultation from an analyst. And I started to think, and this is kind of a dirty little secret. Well, if they're willing to pay me that for 30 minutes of basically public information that you could Google and get, but you know, not consolidated, how much are they getting out of this? So I thought, I need to be on the other side of this.
Oh, they're getting a big multiple, a couple orders of magnitude more than you.
Yeah. Right.
And so I'm 100%. Absolutely.
We have the knowledge. Why should we be giving it away when we can use it for our own advancement? And who's better to bring these products along, forgetting the finances of it, when what we found at Excite is even when we bring very little money to the table for a particular investment, the founders, the innovators, and some of the bigger VCs who do have a lot of money want us on the table because they also know we bring some great ideas for the development plan. Like the success rate of the product is influenced by who's investing. You know this. It's critical to have the right minds around the boardroom and the scientific advisory board room to bring the product, because there's so many pitfalls that the product can fail. And they do, I must say, the bigger VCs do appreciate that in our little niche VC to be able to help out and essentially sometimes guide decision making.
Absolutely. I think the expertise you bring is so important. For a young ophthalmologist, if you are working with a new startup, this is what I do personally, and they want to pay you for your consulting time. If I really believe in their product, I say, just pay me in stock options.
Yeah.
Because I really believe in your company.
That's becoming probably more popularized, and for sure some of the more seasoned advisors like yourself, and I do advising as well, are requesting that and getting it as opposed to, say, fee-for-service kind of arrangements. Right. There are all kinds of hybrids out there, but if you're willing to, you know, put the legwork in and not need the money up front, the upside's certainly greater looking for shares or options for later, because if you really believe in it, you're going to help them get to the finish line.
Right. You have some skin in the game there.
Yeah,
exactly. But I think for all of us, I mean, if I showed you a robot, let's say you're a Wall Street analyst, let's say you're a Wall Street managing director of some big, huge fund, and I showed you a robot doing cataract surgery, what do you know? You can't tell. But I could show any private practice cataract surgeon and say, what do you think of this robot? And they'd say, oh, that's pretty good. Now that means a whole lot more.
Yeah, 100%. And that does come up. And even to that point, even in some ways more nuanced, is like diagnostics. There's so many diagnostics with the modern technology, and people see ophthalmology as an area of growth. So they come in and they bring their technology, say, hey, we can do this with diagnostics. And then a lot of them fail. They don't fail to get approval, some of them. They fail to be relevant. And this is the part where the ophthalmologist who's run clinics and sees where the needs are, but also sees where a new device or diagnostic might fit into the current business model, the current clinical flow model. They just can't see that in the same way. So you might develop this amazing technology, which can, you know, count how many red blood cells there are in the central retinal artery. Oh God, we did it and it turned out it has no relevance. What? Why did we do this, right? So that's an exaggeration and embellishment, but you get the point. We're trying to find ways to make the clinic more streamlined, more effective. And we see where a lot of those shortcomings are in day-to-day clinic and the day-to-day operating room. And then hence you can quickly look at a device and go, yeah, it's a nice technology, but this will actually slow me down. I'm not interested in that. And those ultimately don't sell, even though they become licensed because of an efficacy measurement. So that's an area I found that you really need to get expert clinical advice as these diagnostics, which are big in ophthalmology, as you know.
Right. Right. You need to have the ophthalmologists who have their feet on the ground, hands in the clinic, seeing it every day. Hey, does this make sense in your clinic? Does this make sense in your workflow? You know, another great example is for the robotic company, people would say, well, if the you can do a cataract surgery in 5, 6, 8 minutes, and the robot can do it five, six, 8 minutes, what's the difference? You still supervise the robot.
Yeah.
And I'd say, but I can supervise 4 robots at once. I can look at a screen of 4 robots operating. I can say, you know what, they're all doing great. Oh, that one robot, pause him or her. Pause that robot, pause it. I will come take over, but the other 3 can continue. So now you can, okay, bang, you can increase throughput. Remember, in America, we're still only training 500 cataract surgeons a year, or 500 ophthalmologists, not all who do cataract surgery, a year. We're not training enough to replace the ones who are retiring.
It's surprising, but you're right. And I do think that's the model we should be looking for with the robot for such a procedure. And also for those, you know, we know there's a wide variation of capsular complication rates. Yours is infinitesimally small, I know, because we've worked together a long time. But that will then approach zero, if not zero, right? So forgetting the obvious benefit to the patient, benefit to the surgeon, other than the speed and the improved complication rate, is premium lenses have become sort of a big deal in cataract surgery. Your rate of premium lens possibilities increases tremendously if the outcome is anatomically perfect at or near every time. That improves your chances of offering the premium services. And that may sound like a glib thing, but that's real. And guys want that.
Right. I mean, another good example is still on the robotic thing. I'm so hot on this topic, but you know, if I show you a surgical video on cataractcoach.com, I'll show you a video. The video is going to be shown to you at 25 or maybe 30 frames a second. So if I show your human eye 30 frames in a second, you think it's totally fluid. Now, what if the robot has a camera on there that is at 60 or 120 frames a second? What if there's an OCT on the robot that's 200 frames a second, 400 hertz? Now you've got a machine that can have 10 times your resolution visually as a human, and it can react at least 10 times as fast to on the fly in less than 1/100 of a second. Let's say, boom, change fluidics to prevent the capsule from coming up. So stuff we can't even think about now because we're so used to doing it just with human limitations.
Yeah, that's where the AI part of it, the imaging, as you described, OCT and others, are orders of magnitude more efficacious than human quality. Right. But the AI factor that you brought in, people have said to me, well, gee, like you're positioning the head, and what if the patient moves? And my response is usually, well, they move on us, and the robot will react 22 times faster than I will to pull the instrument in a certain way to avoid accidentally contacting the macula or breaking the capsule, etc. So everything you sort of throw at it, if you add AI to the technology of the actual machinery, you see that it can only be better. It can't be worse. It can only be better because of the speed of the decision-making is instantaneous.
Absolutely.
Or almost instantaneous.
You even leaving ophthalmology for a second, look how far we've come in AI video. A year ago, you could have AI make a video for you of, you know, any kind of scenario you described, and it looked totally fake and ridiculous. Today, a year later, it looks like you filmed it. It looks like it was real life. It's crazy now. That's a year. That's a year.
It's amazing. That's another area that I'm sure will get better. Visualization. Now, this is a big deal for us in the back of the eye, as you know, and Alcon's done a great job. They've brought along Ingenuity, and now other companies are in that space. And this is just, I actually think, you know, right now they're approaching equality with the highest quality microscope. I still trust the highest quality microscope because it's analog and that is the real image. But because of what you just said with filmmaking and so forth, the augmentation that's possible here and the insertion of information along with the image, like OCT guided work, even for the human surgeon, it's only going to advance. And this is using, again, AI and tremendous visualization technology that's being brought to ophthalmology. This is just the beginning. I think that's going to improve a lot.
Wow, yeah. And so tell me about other projects you're involved in, because you have obviously lots of other involvement besides just robotic. And obviously, we also work together on the next generation accommodating IOL, which are hopefully coming soon. But as you were saying, also, you're involved in the glaucoma side, the cornea side, and some stuff.
I want to talk about those two because this will be of interest more to your audience. I know there's a lot of cataract surgeons and anterior segment doctors who are listening. So we have we're involved in a cornea product called Trefoil or Trefoil, depending how you want to pronounce it. It's the New Orleans Saints fleur-de-lis is their insignia, and that is a biological product to, let's say, improve the function of corneal endothelial cells. And it's being tested now clinically in conjunction with or alone in use with corneal surgery, like Decimase procedures. You guys know the names of all these procedures yeah. better than me, but basically to treat various forms of corneal edema, whether it be bullous keratopathy from previous surgery or Fuchs corneal dystrophy. These are pretty common diseases. I mean, right. corneal edema is common and it confounds all of us, including retina surgeons, post-surgery in older people, even in well-done surgery, you can get corneal edema as a complication. So these are biologic products. Trefoil is making a biological product. It isn't human testing and clinical trials now, and we're very excited about it. The founding group is out of San Diego. It turns out a lot of stuff comes out of San Diego and Orange County, as you probably right. know. Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Southern California seem to be big hubs for this stuff, biotech. Mm-hmm. That's a very exciting and interesting product, and we've been in it for a while. And then the glaucoma product is a laser, actually. It's a MIGS procedure to create the hole in the trabecular meshwork using laser as opposed to a mechanical cut down. And in theory that would, and I think in practice, and they have a lot of human clinical data, a lot in Europe, actually. They've done a ton of work in Europe before this, and they wanna embark on an American clinical trial. It could, in theory, reduce complication rates of one leaving behind hardware for a MIGS, in the TM, et cetera, and also reduce bleeding because it's laser dissection as opposed to a blade. So we're excited about that one, too. And we think MIGS is going to continue to be big. Now, some think maybe it's leveling off. Most of the experts don't think so. I think there's still a lot of potential improvement in MIGS. And it turns out the first MIGS people, Glaukos and others, hit on something that giving opportunity to cataract surgeons and general ophthalmologists to surgically treat glaucoma is a big market winner. This is where investment people and business people can also be innovative, right?
Right.
You have to understand the market and study the market. That was a little bit of a gamble in the very beginning. Like, hey, we're going to bring this surgical glaucoma product to general ophthalmologists. I know in the retina space, there's always discussion about, well, we're developing this, but will it fall in the hands of the generalists? And are the retina guys all going to get upset? So there's science to that too. And people underestimate that these people who are designing these clinical protocols then also have to think about how to market the clinical protocol. And there's plenty of pitfalls there. Glaukos hit a home run. It turned out the general ophthalmologists love this concept and they're wanting more and more are developing. And the glaucoma people seem to be okay with it from what I can tell because they're still doing the more complex, more advanced cases.
Sure. I mean, with people living longer, I think we're seeing more glaucoma too.
Oh.
I mean, what percent of 90-year-olds have glaucoma? It's a lot more than the percent of 60-year-olds.
It's huge. And, a lot of the things we do create some glaucoma, certainly in the posterior segment, the treatments we do for retinal detachment and other things, even routine vitrectomy. If you look long term, there's data in perfectly well done simple vitrectomy that years out, some of these eyes have higher pressure. It's not that well explained. Stanley Chang wrote about this a number of years ago. It's turned out to be true. Multiple intravitreal injections for, again, somewhat inexplicable reasons. Now we have millions of people on this, can induce ocular hypertension. So we're going to have another whole slew of patients coming in with either ocular hypertension or glaucoma due to possibly many, many dozens, if not hundreds, of intravitreal injections. So there's more to come. Aging plus the medical procedures that are great, that are helping people, have some side effects.
Perfect. No, for sure. Now, if I'm an ophthalmologist listening to this podcast, how do I get involved?
So the best way to get involved, one, if they can call me. I mean, and I'm always, you know me, I'm always happy to take a call in a meeting. If they know me, that's probably been the simplest way. But we have a website, Excite Ventures, and there's an email on there for contact.
I'll put a link down below. Yeah, I'll put a link down below.
Yeah, there's a contact, and James Murray, the managing partner, you know, fields everything. We get all kinds of incoming from that. Including innovators who want to talk with us who we haven't met before. Most of those come in directly by calls also. We become name brand in ophthalmology, so we get all kinds of calls from the innovators and the early startups, and we're very proud of that. And we talk to every one of them. We schedule everyone, and we learn from these calls. But also for the ophthalmologists who want to be involved, the website is the probably the easiest way, because they can do it sitting from their phone. But there's also phone numbers, and they can call. And if they email, say, hey, I want to talk to, you know, Firas Rahal about this. Can you give me a call? I'll call them back.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. So that's interesting. Yeah. On both sides, not only on the investing side, but also on the seeking backing side. Like, I have a great idea, great project, a great this. Can I get this across your desk? And maybe you guys want to invest in me.
100%. This is probably the most common thing we get is on that side. And we, you know, Mark Blumenkrantz, who's a kind of legend in this space of spinning out companies and investing early in ophthalmology technologies, other people have called it this. He referred it to me first, so I'm going to credit him. The valley of death, you know, early stage biotech or ophthalmology investing is where, like, it's a little late for friends and family, which gets the project maybe off the ground with small amounts of money. And it's a little early for bigger traditional VCs who need to write a $50 or $100 million check every time and aren't interested in that kind of risk or small investment. It's too much work for them. So these pre-Series A and Series A investments, post-seed investment, is where there's a huge gap, and we're trying to fill that gap. There's some others like us, but there's not a lot. So we get a ton of calls. Those are the need areas where they want to raise money, and it's tough because there's a bit of a catch-22. They need to show more data before they can raise money, but they can't get more data until they get some money. So it's fun, and we have to be super selective. We've definitely heard pitches from, I think it's now well over 400, maybe even more innovators and companies over the last 9+ years since we've been doing this regularly. And we've made the 12 or so investments. So it shows you the number, right? It's a 1% or 2% rate of us finally pulling the trigger. And when we do, we've usually done diligence for a minimum of a year and often up to 18 months. We're a little slow, but we like to see how the product is evolving in those early stages typically. And we stay in touch with the innovator and the CEO, if there is a CEO, learn what they're doing. We get to know them very well by the time we pull the trigger. And we feel better about that. We have a lot of LPs who are depending on us to spend their money wisely. Mm-hmm. And so we put a lot of work into it.
Yeah, so I like that idea that obviously you're doing so much due diligence here that you're very selective. You're investing in, like, let's say less than 5% of the companies that are pitched to you. And then when you do, you like to see a little bit of a track record, not just what you're doing today, but let me follow for a year or 18 months and see what you're doing. What progress are you making?
That's exactly right. And I don't think we went into it with that plan necessarily in mind prospectively, but we saw that's sort of how we were doing it. And it became kind of our system. And it makes a lot of sense because one of the advantages of being really early is there aren't that many knowledgeable investors who want to get right in into that space. Again, the bigger knowledgeable investors are often later stage. It's de-risked a little bit more.
Right.
So we have the luxury of not missing the boat, let's say, by waiting a little bit. Yeah, maybe the cost goes up a little, but often it doesn't, because these are still very early stage. And you can see a lot in 12 to 18 months. You see managerial decisions. You see innovation decisions. You see just even hiring decisions, like, oh, who is this person? Why are they in the company now? And you sort of figure it out, and you see the decision-making of the management sort of play out before you. And you also see the realism or the lack thereof of the time plan that they originally projected to you, you know, the time course of hitting milestones. It's always slower than is projected anyway, kind of like building a room on your house, but you want it to be not too much slower than was projected. So you can see that in real time. That's very valuable.
I mean, one of the challenges I had was, you know, if it's a company that I'm working with directly, and I know the people in the company, let's say I'm doing some consulting work for them, ophthalmic consulting, then it's easy enough for me to get involved and maybe get stock options or buy into the company or invest. But for other companies, I don't have an in. I'm not doing any consulting with any, you know, mixed companies now. I'm not doing any consulting with any corneal companies. And I certainly barely know how to spell retina. So I'm not investing in retina companies. But the nice part with me, I thought, wow, with this, by being part of this VC fund, I can be involved in all of these projects.
Yep.
And I have an in to basically the future of our specialty.
Totally. And believe it or not, yes, compared to a retina doctor, you may not understand the retina, but compared to the other 99.9% of the world, you know the retina very well. And my point about that is because of the exposure you'll have with us receiving these hundreds of pitches that wouldn't necessarily come to me alone or to you alone, right. It may be in our own little spaces, you do have an opportunity, we all do, to participate in these other parts of ophthalmology that aren't necessarily directly within our wheelhouse and even be on advisory boards and so forth in areas that wouldn't have been necessarily in you a wheelhouse for you. But given that you're now part of the company in one way or another as an investor and you're there handy and they've seen what you know, it's interesting that this is how I think sometimes you see advisory boards and you're like, what's the glaucoma guy doing on there? And then you realize he was part of the early stage of the development of the company and really understands that niche space very well, better than maybe the retina guy did, who is a general retina guy. People like yourself who have this kind of expertise and have done all the teaching and have all the industry contacts, that brings great value. Company, the industry contracts alone brings great value. And again, to my young colleagues out there who are interested in this space and developing a business career alongside their clinical career, don't take too lightly this. Your contacts with the industry that have come about organically have tremendous value to investors and large VCs and bankers and so forth, because they don't have access to that stuff. And we do. And again, we shouldn't just give it away. That's ours.
Yeah. If you take nothing else from this whole conversation, stop giving away what you learned in that decade called your 20s. You gave away your 20s.
Yes.
That acquired some incredible knowledge, incredible skill that it's extremely rare.
Yep.
And the Wall Street people figure it out on their own, and you keep your cards close to your chest.
I agree totally. And I've been saying this, and I know you have been too. It's funny. I don't think it's a common refrain. Maybe it's becoming more common, but I've talked about it with you for years, and I think we're way better as a field now. And in large part, people like you writing in the journals, and I remember your article about being a KOL and what that entails. And I think people learn from that and see, hey, you know, there's opportunities here. I've been giving it away. I think we're definitely better now than we were 20 years ago, but we still could take a lot more control over the innovations and finance of our own space.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. And like I said, to me, it also keeps it fun. It keeps it fun and exciting. So that I have new things coming across my desk. We all love ophthalmology. We all feel blessed to be ophthalmologists. We stumbled across this amazing field. But like when things come across my desk, like, you know, let me dissect this a little bit. Let me read about this a little bit more. Let me understand it more. How does this exactly work? I was actually looking up some of the stuff with the fused dystrophy and the endothelial rejuvenation, if you will.
Yeah.
And because obviously it is, as a cataract surgeon, I see fused dystrophy every week.
Yeah.
And so I just did
it's exciting stuff, and it sort of seems to come out of nowhere. But to give credit to these folks at Trefoil and all these other great startups, there's so much basic science done in the beginning behind the scenes that nobody knows is going on. These brilliant guys at universities figuring out mediators and pathways and putting in the work and putting in the hours and the years. And sometimes our role is, even if we don't invest, we help them to learn how to spin it out and benefit from their own expertise. And even if we're not investing, we've become sort of known for that. People call us and ask opinion and help, and we're happy to do it because we find it fun as well.
That's fantastic. Now, I'm going to ask something a little unusual here. I've never done this on a podcast before, but maybe I can actually also email James Murray and get him for like a brief 15-minute part on the same podcast to get his input from his more business side, because he's not a clinician.
Totally. James, listen, you asked me all these great questions and I answered to the best of my ability, but on the technical side, valuations, and this is James's wheelhouse. He's really good at it. He's kind of the backbone of the financial part of this business, which is obviously the most critical, perhaps. We bring in scientific knowledge and understanding of innovation and so forth, but it's still a VC company and somebody has to know the real nuts and bolts. And Michael and I have learned a lot from him over these years, but yeah,
Michael, it would be Michael Nissen, your fellow retina surgeon.
Correct. And he's one of the, I think this is sort of his brainchild, but although right. James was there from the beginning too. And then they invited me to found it together, which we all founded it together, but I can't take credit for the idea. It came to me from the two of them. And Michael actually flew out to LA to the Retina Society meeting. I don't know if he remembers this, more than a decade ago, and said, look, I know how insanely busy you are and you're doing trials and you got a wife and kids and you have one of the biggest clinical practices in the country. I'm going to ask you to do more. I'm like, what are you asking me for? And he said, you know, he wanted to found a VC together. And I'm like, gee, that doesn't sound like a little more. That sounds like a lot more. But I've tailored my schedule and this has been a great ride with him and with James. And I'm glad you're on board. It's going to be more fun and more successes. And yes, I think you should ask James to come on and get some of the lowdown on how some of the technical aspects of the finances.
Right. Oh, I definitely will. That'll be fantastic. Well, Frost, I want to thank you for being on this podcast. I'm so impressed of how much Excite Ventures has grown over the last like almost decade. It's really quite remarkable. I'm glad I'm like part of the process on the early stage now.
Thank you.
I want to thank you. What a fantastic podcast. I learned so much. I think all ophthalmologists, you already invest in ophthalmology, in your clinic, in your surgeries, in your patients. Ultimately, listen, your number one thing is you get paid to do surgery, to do ophthalmology. But I think for us to have a control or an input into like the future of our field, being able to invest in something that we have a deep knowledge of, I think it's a really empowering thing. And it's like, it brings me so much pleasure.
Thanks, Uday. I'm really appreciative to come on. I appreciate those nice comments. And I'm most appreciative also that you've joined up with us. And we're looking forward to the next decade being the best one ever.
Hey, so am I. So again, my viewers, stay tuned. Don't hang up the podcast just yet. I'm going to have an add-on segment coming up just soon with James Murray, who is going to tell us all about the intricacies and the details of the finance side. Stay tuned. So we just finished that podcast with Dr. Faraz Rahal, and his partner, James Murray, is here to answer a few questions for us and give us more insight about what is Excite Ventures. So James, welcome.
It's great to be here, man. I heard you and Faraz had a great conversation.
It was fantastic. So tell us all about Excite Ventures. What's your background and what are you involved in?
Yeah, unlike you and Faraz, I'm not a clinician. I have no technical background. I'm an attorney by training, worked in asset management at the beginning of my career, a number of roles. Ultimately, I wanted to go into venture. And in that context, I was introduced to our other partner, Michael Nissen, a vitreoretinal surgeon here in New York. And he said, listen, ophthalmology is a really interesting and innovative place. And I see some opportunities every year to invest in, but I don't know how to, you know, figure out what a term sheet is or what good terms are or what my preference is. Maybe we could work together. And I was a total skeptic. Just, I was like, venture is hard enough. Life science venture, biotech, medical devices, even more challenging. Early stage is impossible if you look at the numbers. And now you want to look at this one little area of the body, right?
And ophthalmology is so unusual. And plus, don't forget, all ophthalmologists, like all MDs, we have essentially zero business training.
That's right. Although you guys are great businessmen, as Michael Frost and you are, right? You figure it out. And I think that gives us an interesting edge. So yeah, I was like, this never works. this will never work, but listen, you know, you seem like a great guy. Let's have a conversation. And immediately I was kind of blown away and surprised by the opportunity set. And for a few reasons. One, it's a classic kind of valley of death, early stage funding gap that was so prominent and so prevalent.
Explain that to us again, because Faraz mentioned this yesterday about the valley of death. So that means what? Like, it's easy to get money early on, like the friends and family money. Then you've got a valley where it's hard to get money. And then once you get going, there's more.
That's right. So, you know, think about how biotech and life science companies are typically started. Typically, it's started in university level in a research lab. So there's grant funding, there's university dollars. And then, as you said, you know, once you spin that out, there's some friends and family willing to invest, willing to put up your own personal capital. And maybe some early stage grant funding through NIH or otherwise, SBIRs. But then there really aren't many funds that will write $5 to $10 million checks. And that's a structural issue because there are big funds out there that write, you know, they've got 600 plus million under management. And in order for them to move the needle on their fund, they have to write $30 to $50 million check minimum. So when we started all the way 10 years ago, and I looked at this, that check size was 30 million. Some funds now are up to 50 and 60 million. And across that, they also have their own syndicate partners. So they need to write $100 million total round sizes just to move the needle and to make something interesting. And as you know, a lot of innovation happens for much less, and it's much more capital efficient. So me as the finance guy back then, right, just kind of looking at this going, this seems really inefficient to just throw a bunch of money at an early stage opportunity before it even proves itself out. You know, the old adage goes, many companies will not die from starvation, but die from indigestion, right? So when you throw $100 million at a biotech company that has yet to pick a lead candidate, and then you got that valuation step up, and you messed up the cap table with all these big funds, and then they stumble, and then they need to go back and re-raise, oftentimes those funds will just write that off, right? So to me, that's kind of that valley of death that we wanted to step in and utilize. And around that point, that's when Michael brought in Faraz. He said, if we do this, man, we got to bring in Faraz. He knows everyone. He's been involved in tons of clinical trials. And so we met him. And I looked at this and I said, this is exactly what you want, right? You got this capital inefficiency, but then it's early stage, so it's very high risk. Well, how are we going to identify the good opportunities that can be de-risked? And you do that through expertise. You can't be a generalist going, you know, could you go look at, I'm sure you could, but cardiovascular.
No, of course not. I have no idea because my knowledge is so, my depth is so little in that. But show me anything, cataract, ophthalmology, anterior segment. I have such depth that that's what to me is comforting. That limits my risk. So I always see these things as low risk. If I know the field, if it's a cataract investment, you can't pull the wool over my eyes.
Right, right, exactly, exactly. And then, so Michael and Frost, then, as you may have also, right, as many surgeons and clinicians do, they serve as experts to other funds and and GLG, to use an example, these expert networks, where you'll get a phone call and they'll prepare you with some information. They just want to get your opinion. But what they can't know in that role that we know that we've been doing for 10 years is all of the deal flow. So they may serve up to you 3 to 4 companies in with an IOL, say, right? Well, over the last 10 years, we've seen dozens of companies. And once you kind of raise the flag, and this was a big part early on to determine whether or not we could do this and say, hey, listen, we're an early stage ophthalmology fund. Guess what? There aren't that many. There weren't any then. We now have, you know, some colleagues in the business. But you get a lot of deal flow. Everybody with an early stage ophthalmology asset comes to you and says, what do you think of this, right? So that's another reason that specialization really helps rather than just being a generalist.
So the average amount you typically invest in a company ranges from what to what? What's typical?
Yeah, so historically we've raised, you know, several funds and they're smaller proof of concepts. So our initial check size anywhere from $250K up to $1 million. And we do that through a number of vehicles, whether it's through the fund or SPVs, where we have our investors participate alongside us, and sometimes we'll bring in other.
Tell us again, what's an SPV?
Yeah, sorry, I use a lot of lingo and acronyms. Special purpose vehicle. So that means, you know, say Uday startup, right? You come over and you say, hey, I got this startup. And we'll say, great, we'd love to write a check. We'll put in, say, $500,000 from the fund. And alongside of that, it's just a single vehicle that is meant to only invest in this one company rather than the, you know, 5 to 15 companies that a portfolio will have.
Right.
Right.
So I like the concept of having the portfolio investing. So like some of the investments that I've made personally in Excite is, you know, that it's a fund that invests now in maybe, you said, you know, 10-ish, maybe 15 different companies, you know, all in ophthalmology.
That's right. So the strategy more broadly, right, where we're going more broadly has the opportunity to capacity to for $75 to $100 million, right? And that will be 14 to 18 portfolio companies writing check sizes from $250K up to $4 million for initial checks. And, you know,
those are checks you write to the companies as because you're investing as part of your big fund.
Correct. Right. And we'll reserve about half for follow on. That's fair, you know, kind of 40 to 60% is the rule of thumb, because as these companies go on, you know, they need to raise more and more capital. And we want to make sure that we have the ability to maintain our percentage ownership, particularly in the ones that do well. Right.
Of course. And you've had a few home runs. You had a few, as you would say, exits from certain companies.
Yes. Yeah. So we were very lucky early on. We made an investment with just partner capital. This is 2015 or so, into a company called RetroSense, and 11 months later acquired by Allergan. So one for one right out of the gate. And that brought a lot of our LPs to the table. You know, we had gone to them with this wacky idea of an early stage ophthalmology fund. And they went, no, thanks. Interesting. We like you guys, but that's just too far afield for us. But then we had that one exit. And they came back to us and said, maybe you're onto something. So that started our first fund and so on. And then last year, a company called DTX was acquired by Novartis. And I think, you know, this more broadly speaks to why ophthalmology is, you know, such an interesting space. Because the eye is an ideal proving ground for emerging technologies that could apply to other areas, right? So this was an siRNA technology. And initially they conceived of an anti-VEGF program. You know, there was some back and forth, and ultimately they went with gene agnostic retinitis pigmentosa indication, but also it's a platform technology. So there are indications outside of ophthalmology, and ultimately one in Charcot-Marie tooth catapulted the ophthalmology. And that's fine for us, right? Because our early expertise provided that insight. And if you can go just beyond the eye, right? So we had that early insight, Michael and Faraz using their clinical insights and their scientific background, looked at that asset and said, oh, this is really interesting. You're onto something. And we made the investment. Could have invested earlier. We were between funds, you know.
that's fantastic. Always good to have that kind of success. And the part I like is when I'm investing in one of your funds, I have a say. I like when you run the companies by me. What's my take on this? Does this sound like a reasonable technology or not? And I love to give that input.
Exactly. And so, you know, we're really just crowdsourcing our investors' expertise, right? And it's great. And they're aligned in our interests, right? You're an investor, you're an LP in our funds, and you actually have something at stake rather than just a phone call or a small consultation fee for your hour, right? We're aligned. So we call you up and we'll get the real background. You'll know the individuals involved oftentimes, and you'll know the technology inside and out. And we can have really candid conversations around that. And I think that it's so important when you're looking at early stage assets in anything, you know, particularly here in ophthalmology and healthcare.
So if any of our ophthalmologists who are listening to this podcast want to know more or want to potentially invest, what's the minimum amount investing? How do they contact you? I mean, I'll leave a link down below for them, but.
Yeah. Minimum, I'm going to not get into details and specifics. It varies. So if you come into one of our SPVs, we typically administer those through AngelList, and that's discretionary, right? You know, so it can be anywhere from $1,000 on up, and that's just driven by the platform. And then any of our funds, you know, just more broadly, more typically, there are certain SEC rules. I'm not going to put your audience to sleep with these here. But typically for the fund math to make sense, a rule of thumb for an early stage fund is a $250K investment. But, you know, I think within the universe of venture funds and venture investing, where you're looking at LPs, there's a range of investments. It's anything that I mentioned, that $1,000 to $250, all the way up to, you know, $5 to $15, or somebody that can really anchor a fund.
Right, whatever your personal comfort level is, et cetera.
Yeah, and listen, we want people to be involved, right? So we're looking at programs that are even earlier stage than what we would look at for a fund investment, right? Where we want to work with an entrepreneur, and we're looking at creating a program to do some really early stage de-risking, where it may take $50K to $250K for lab space and to run some preclinical studies. And what we'd look to do is to utilize the network of people that we have, right? Where, right, hey, this is more of an angel network. We're going to vet this. It's too early for the fund, but you, as an ophthalmologist that has that expertise, maybe you look at this and say it's interesting. We think it's interesting. It's just not quite ready yet. So, you know, we're looking at a range of options. And then over time, so that's kind of the angel phase. Our main target that we've been working on for many years is that early stage, right? Seed to Series B, right? That classic valley of death we started talking about. And then later stage, for our companies that graduate and move on and are raising at $150 million valuations, you know, we want a later stage fund down the road to really invest in those companies where, you know, where others from the field are coming in, the big funds, the big strategics, right? And they're writing $60 million checks. That'll allow us to participate really across the continuum, everything from seed to later stage, and give you know, LPs an opportunity to do so also.
For sure. So if an ophthalmologist has like a great new little baby startup, like a garage startup, they can also contact you, come to you and say, hey, you know, would you consider funding us?
Absolutely. So anyone can find us on excitementventures.com. We've got a link up for you, excitementventures.com/Uday, right? And that way they can find us. We can get in touch, you know, if you want to, if you're interested in talking to us in any context. And for companies, it's never too early. People always say, oh, I wasn't quite sure. It's never too early, because our typical lead time on an investment is about 2 years, because this is really early stage stuff. Mm-hmm. Company that we both know, Horizon, we talked to many years we talked to them before there was even a company. So it's never too early, right? It's never too early. We want to get to know you. We want to get to know the asset. We can help provide advice along the way, non-dilutive funding and others, you know, just feedback on how you should think about certain things. And because startups are hard, right? They're really hard. And we've seen a lot over the last 10 years. We made 13 investments. We've diligenced hundreds and hundreds of companies. And so we're here to be a resource to the community.
Well, I think it's fantastic. Yeah. Everything we do was started as a little baby startup. Every single thing that we do in ophthalmology, that's the neat part of it. And the nice part of ophthalmology too, is that ophthalmology is constantly changing. That's the only constant is change. It's always changing, always evolving, always new stuff.
You guys as a field, and this, I think this is what resonated with me early on and inspired me. It's so innovative. You guys are always thinking, how can we do better? It's very, you know, iterative and never satisfied. It's like, what's next? How can we help patients more? How can we be more efficient? And there's always room for innovation. And now in a world where you're seeing regenerative medicine, surgical robotics, well, the eye is a great proving ground for that, right? Because it's as Frost says, certain unique anatomic sequestration and different features, right?
It's a protected space. I mean, even like the first gene therapy now is Luxturna, right, in the eye,
right?
So you can see this.
Exactly.
Or even a lot of other technologies now. OCT, it's finding its way to other parts of medicine, or how we ophthalmology paved the way for anti-VEGF stuff. So it can start in the eye, but it may then expand to the rest of the body.
Exactly right. Exactly. And we have to, you know, when we're pitching non-ophthalmologist LPs and we're telling them, why should you care about the eye? That's what we tell them, right? And if you look at that, the company DTX that was acquired by Novartis, perfect example, right?
Right. No, exactly.
The eye, and then technology works in other areas of the body.
Well, I'm a fan of what you do. I'm really, I'm honored to be a part of Excite Ventures as you say, an LP or limited partner.
That's right.
And I certainly encourage other people, do your own due diligence, check it out. To me, it's definitely the right fit. And I look forward to being involved with you and your team. to evaluate hundreds of more potential companies so we can all kind of grow together.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on. I can finally be on a cataract coach after watching many, many videos and trying to figure out what you guys actually do in surgery.
Awesome. Well, I'm honored. We'll have this podcast up shortly. And again, I'll have links down below. It'll be in the description of the podcast. Again, it's exciteventures.com/Uday, U-D-A-Y. All right, James. Thank you so much. I sincerely appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
I want to remind you guys, remember, new podcast every single week, every Sunday on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, YouTube, anywhere you find your podcast. We will catch you next time.